Hello, sir. How's it going?
Good, good. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. I'm just going to let Sal in as well. It's great to have you on here.
Same here, same here. Looking forward.
Sal, what's going on? You're sideways.
Oh, shit. Tell me I'm supposed to be sideways.
Oh, well.
Did you say you haven't slept for 24 hours or something like that?
No, I sat on a plane for 24 hours. I went from San Juan to Houston, directly to Houston, to San Francisco, and then San Francisco to Hong Kong. So it was like the worst, I think the longest trip I've ever had. It was insane. But I'm glad to be back here now.
I wanted to actually start by, you know, talking a little bit about your background, because, you know, you have a pretty differentiated background for the space. And I think in a field that is kind of getting bigger and wider, to be honest, with a broader group of sort of people coming into it, I think your background really stands out. So I'd love to hear a little bit about you and kind of how you got to where you are.
Yeah, first of all, thank you guys for having me in the podcast. I have been following it myself. It's amazing content you guys are putting out there. So, you know, for us, it's also really a pleasure, you know, to be here and discuss with you guys. A few words about myself and my background. So I come from the IoT world. By studies, I have a PhD in wireless communication. The specialization of my PhD was localization algorithms and location-enabled services. Worked with pretty much, any kinds of infrastructure, satellite base, which is GPS, as you know it, on Earth infrastructure, which is RTK, cameras, lidars, to essentially localize an object or an autonomous object, right? Started my career in the autonomous driving industry. This was back in 2013. We were working, you know, around IoT before that, but you know, back in the times, autonomous driving industry or automotive was the sector that was paying the bills for IoT. So started there and became part of a €6 million project. And the goal of the project was to increase the localization accuracy of autonomous cars below 25 centimeters, so that they can do lane level, you know, navigation. And as part of this project, we actually started coining a term called local dynamic map, which is very similar to what we're doing at Natix today. And essentially the idea was we're gonna tap into optical sensors of the vehicle, which was cameras and lidars at the time. Today is the same thing, by the way. Collect real-time information from the road, collisions, obstacles on the road, label it with time and very precise location, and communicate this with neighboring vehicles so that they can make better, faster decisions, right? Why did we call it local dynamic maps? For each one of these words, there was a reasoning. Local because it serves a local purpose. There was no reason to host this data globally. So edge computing, edge storage was another topic that we were focusing on. Dynamic because it's all kinds of dynamic information. We're not covering any static map information, like where the roads are, where the buildings are, and so on. And map because it's geospatial data at the end of the day. Then I joined PwC. I was doing a lot of business and strategy. You know, fellow PwC colleagues, I love them, but, you know, it was a lot of, you know, I call it, excuse my language, you can cut it out as well, but it was a lot of innovation whorehouse. It was fun. They were paying us a lot of money, corporate clients, to really build them something around what we called emerging technologies. So eight technologies that we identified: blockchain, IoT, AI, AR, VR, you know, robotics, and so on. And I was mostly doing IoT and blockchain. Met my co-founder there. We actually did a lot of really, really cool stuff. You know, my co-founder, Omid, and our CTO, he built a ZK identity solution back in 2017. You know, I had no idea what ZK is before he told me about it. He was doing some testing on homomorphic encryption, decentralized compute. And yeah, anyway, we got tired of our jobs. It was a great experience, but at some point we said, okay, we want to see our products beyond corporate boards and the POCs that we were doing. So we want to see it scale. So we quit. We started our own journey. Natix, actually, or the team behind Natix, we started work on a decentralized compute platform, which is a very hot topic today, right? So we started writing the technical paper, did a couple of POCs, and, you know, started the fundraising rally. The first check that we got was from Plug and Play Ventures. They're very, Web2, well known for writing early stage checks. And the general partner who has you know, quite a few, you know, a handful of unicorns already in his portfolio. He said, look, guys, I love the idea. I love the team. A couple of issues that I see here. First of all, you guys are first-time founders. Second of all, this idea of yours requires a lot of money, you know, north of $10, $20 million to build. Yeah, because it was futuristic. Back in 2018, 2019, this was still a very, very futuristic idea in many angles of it. And third of all, it's a bear market right now. This was like end of 2019. And it was like, yeah, good luck raising that much. So we said, okay, what do we do? And he said, I actually encourage you guys to niche it down into something small, build a product, traction, you know, and then take it on from there. And if you want to take it to the direction that you're envisioning right now, do it, but start small and build traction, which means customers, revenue, all kinds of Web2 fundamentals, I call them. So we did that, and the kind of the idea iterated into AI being computer vision AI, and you know, the computer being just the edge computer, because we wanted to actually build a decentralized edge computing platform for IoT applications. So we started to work heavily with cameras and computer vision AI. So we started to work on this edge AI stack. The USP of our AI stack is that it's privacy compliant. We started building it in 2020, 2021. We put it in form of different products for different use cases and applications, monitoring parking, you know, occupancy, monitoring crowd for public, let's say, authorities to know where to be present, you know, to be present at the right time, at the right place, security surveillance for corporate, you know, companies. And yeah, we generated quite a good amount of revenue that year. And then we realized it's just maybe not scalable. Yeah, because when we wanted to scale with our customers from 20 cameras to 2,000 cameras, it was a huge, you know, time to decision, big CapEx investment for them. So we said, all right, why don't we try to, you know, we are Deepin native. Deepin was not a word back in the time, but we are native to this tokenized infrastructure. So why don't we crowdsource the infrastructure and tokenize it to bootstrap the network? That's how Natix Network was born. And I very clearly remember our tagline was, we want to create Helium for smart cameras, because that's the model that we knew that succeeded. And yeah, that's how we started Natix. Then we went to Techstars Accelerator Program. They are a second largest accelerator after Y Combinator. Really very similar, you know, acceleration that they do. It was one of the best experiences I've had as a founder. They polish you as a founder. They polish you as a business. They help you pivot. And that's what they did with us as well. And when we graduated, we knew exactly what is our go-to-market, which became this a smartphone application, Drive An App, which you guys might have heard of. And yeah, the rest of it, I guess everyone knows. You know, we launched the application 1 year fast forward from the launch. Actually, our anniversary is tomorrow, 4th of April. And yeah, we have, I think today we have over 84,000 registered drivers and over 22 million kilometers of road covered. And the numbers are growing at a super, super fast pace. Community is doing over 350,000 kilometers, if not even more. My numbers are a few days outdated and they're growing quite fast. But yeah, so we have been building through the previous bear market, you know, one even before that. And right now it's a good market for Deepin, and you know, we're happy that we're at the center of it, but it was a lot of hard work for past 2-3 years to really get here.
Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense. And it sounds like, you know, things that you've been working for a number of years have kind of coalesced into what you're building now in a very serendipitous way. And it's a really interesting, the number of high quality projects that I see out there today that started as some form of decentralized compute is actually blowing my mind. So, you know, it seems like that's kind of the university from which a lot of the good deep thinkers have kind of come out. So appreciate that color. I'd love to dive a little bit more into Natix itself. And, you know, we have a lot of viewers here, obviously, that that know Deepin and understand Deepin, but we have a lot that maybe are on the earlier stage of their journey as well. So, you know, if you could just maybe give us in a couple of minutes at a high level, sort of how you think about what you guys are really offering and how you're going about it, just an overview of kind of Natix itself would be really, really helpful.
So Natix is creating an open geospatial intelligence network. And the source of data for this network that we are building is what we call Internet of Cameras. It's a crowdsourced camera network that is also supercharged by, tokenization, essentially, or DeepIn. In an essence, that's where Netix wants to be also in a few years. We want to build the largest camera infrastructure in the world without owning a single camera, the same way that Uber has the largest taxi network in the world without owning a single taxi. Why do we want to bet on cameras? Because camera is the most powerful sensor that you can have today. When you're comparing what the sensor can do versus the price of it. I mean, it's a commodity sensor. That's why Tesla has been betting on cameras, even compared to LiDARs and other sensors that are very, very rich as well. Camera is something that is extremely scalable. And when you combine it with computer vision AI, I have a saying that I say, sky is not the limit, AI is the limit, and AI is growing at a super fast pace, right? So what a camera network, or I call it the smart camera network, can do, you can think of it as what a pair of eyes and a working brain can do. Really, all kinds of contextual understanding of the environment, this can be done through a camera network. That's kind of where we see ourselves in a few years. But obviously, the project right now, everyone knows us with our smartphone product. So it's a driver companion app that rewards the users for roaming around and collecting rich geospatial data. So essentially, you just download the app, put the phone on the dashboard of your car. As you're driving around, the AI is scanning the road and it's detecting what the AI is trained to detect, like potholes, traffic congestions, how many cars are there, how many bicycles, and you actually earn reward. And yeah, I mean, it's a gamified, fun app. You get a ton of other driver assistant applications from it, like dash cam, navigation is going to come out very, very soon, parking availability. This is DriveN, our flagship product that has already, quite a good amount of traction.
That's awesome. So camera network in the medium to long term, bootstrapping, kind of using drivers for now, definitely makes sense as a wedge. I'd be curious to sort of get your vision for how you kind of see that evolving over time. Because, something like the driver network, we've seen Hive Mapper scale so quickly. Now, let's say, you've got hundreds of thousands of drivers with cameras already. Is the goal to really proliferate the driving side of it? Or would you then start moving to other applications? I guess it would be really helpful if you could kind of paint us a little bit of a vision for what that broader camera network looks like in the long run.
Look, today we have over 45 billion cameras in form of smartphones, car cameras, drone cameras, CCTV cameras. And, for me, camera is camera for our vision, right? As long as you have edge computers connected to the camera, we're actually increasing amount of these cameras are by default getting equipped with edge computers, AI accelerated chips. That's what I'm talking about. This makes them, perfect sensor, Even if they're not, you can retrofit them with an edge AI chip, right? Or edge computer, which again, I mean, this was our Web2 business, by the way, before pivot into Netix Network. We were retrofitting existing CCTV cameras. You just connect a little box the size of the palm of your hand to one, two, even up to three cameras. And then you can run the, computer vision AI there. We can tap into pretty much all of this market eventually. Each one of them will have its own user persona, own application. So, it's going to be a different product at the end of the day. But hey, Helium started with narrowband IoT and kind of IoT network. And now they're doing 5G, which is even, in my opinion, is more successful than their IoT network. And they're expanding, right? So the same way that Helium wants to build this kind of connectivity infrastructure, if I don't butcher their narrative and their vision, with all kinds of different elements in it, we are also wanting to, build this camera infrastructure with all kinds of applications in it. And I can, we can dig deep into each one of these. You can pick any of them that you like, and I can tell you, how we envision it. It's going to be different products, different user personas, and different applications at the end of the day.
Got it. That makes a lot of sense. Maybe we'll dig into that in a sec. But, something that I've been thinking a lot about, maybe it's an unfair distinction, but is this distinction almost between software and hardware, right? I think a lot of people see Hive Mapper and they see, you buy a camera and you put it up and it works. And with you guys, it's kind of a lot easier because it's using hardware that already exists. Could you talk a little bit about that? Because the other thing that I always consider when I think about this is, you know, how do you build a moat when you're really thinking about something like a hardware versus a software-based network? Because, you know, the switching costs are obviously way lower.
Yeah. So I really like this software versus hardware deepen. I think you guys coined it in your deepen report, if I'm not wrong. And this is a very, very smart way of categorizing it because, you know, software projects like us, we do categorize ourselves at the moment with our product DriveN as a software deepen. The barrier to entry is much lower. Emission system should be slightly different than hardware, you know, base ones. Usually the emission is a little bit higher for the hardware one, or they try to, you know, incentivize the people because they need to pay for the piece. They need to wait for the logistics of it and so on. So it's just a different kind of environment. You know, then within software, we have, I would say, passive one and active one, right? Again, correct me, Mahesh, I would like to know what you also think about this, but you have, let's say, a plugin for Filecoin or a middleware that you just install and you're sharing your, you know, storage or for some other project, you're doing bandwidths or whatnot. And then you have projects like Natix or Silencio or whatnot that, you know, it's on your smartphone and you need to do a certain amount of activity, right? In Natix, you need to open your app, put it on the dashboard of your car, and kind of start driving around to collect data, right? So for each one of these, I would say then you have a different kind of mechanics, right, that you need to think about. The deepen environment is very young today, but believe me when I said we actually thought about it. So we compared ourselves with projects that are hardware-based. We compared ourselves with the projects that are, you know, passive versus active. And we tried to design a product as well as a tokenomics that fits that, right? But yeah, this is a very, very interesting distinction. I would say if you're software and you're active, if you also go software passive versus active. There's also a new terminology. I had a chat with the guys at Borderless. They also call it commodity deepen. I hope I didn't ruin the term for them because they want to write. But I'm actually giving them the credit that they call it commodity deepen because pretty much anyone has the chance to join certain types of deepens, right? Like us.
Yeah, no, definitely makes sense. And, you know, we think about the difference between passive and active, software versus hardware. I think background versus foreground is also a big one of like how like prominent the application is in its use on your phone. Like, does it something that has to be on all the time? Is it something that has to be constantly engaged if you're kind of switching around in applications? Does that sort of change? I'd love to maybe double down on the phone aspect of this because, you know, one of the really interesting things that I see around Twitter, and we had Ariel from HiveMapper on here a few weeks ago, is, you know, this thought that maybe smartphones might not be the best conduit. Especially at this moment to, you know, map in an extremely high quality way. You know, personally, I'm not 100% sure about that. I'd love your take on what you think.
Yeah, so I have a strong opinion on smartphone and I see that, you know, our hardware competitor is pretty much, you know, trying to convince the entire world that that is not possible. I mean, sometimes I don't know, like we can always argue back and forth and we can give our own reasonings, but I would like to actually do a comprehensive right now reasoning why a smartphone is good enough for mapping. And also give you guys examples of the success models that are there. Maybe Natix is too young, but you know, there are success models even in the Web2 world that did it, you know, with smartphone. And they are, you know, they are legit mapping infrastructures, crowdsource as well, and so on. So why did we choose smartphone, first of all? I mean, it's a no-brainer. It's more scalable, right? To onboard a node, it's mere seconds rather than, you know, ordering a hardware, dealing with the logistics, and, you know, getting it delivered months later, right? So that was kind of the main reason. But what also people don't know, many people, is that smartphones are, first of all, supercomputers. And second of all, sensor hotels in your pocket. What do I mean by that? Any smartphone since 2016, 2017, they have AI accelerated chips. If you're talking Apple, they have Bionic chip. Very, very strong chipset, by the way. And then you have Apple Core ML, which you can, you know, it's a framework to push machine learning models into this chipset. And it's a charm. If you guys have ever worked with it, you will know what I mean. That's why I take my hat off when Apple brings any kinds of hardware into the market. If you're talking Android, you have Qualcomm Snapdragon, which is a very famous chipset, or something very, very similar, right? So they can run AI very, very efficiently. On top of that, they have pretty much a lot of other sensors that you might need for a deepened project. GPS, gyroscope, even new iPhones have LiDAR. It's a lower range LiDAR than what you have, you know, in cars, right? It's tens of meters rather than hundreds of meters range, but it will get even better from there on. So essentially, it's a super sensor and a supercomputer that you have in your pocket. The other reason is it can actually serve as a utility hub to your users, right? One of the biggest things that we have been talking about is if the only utility of your product is for people to earn money, I think it's a very poor product development, in my opinion. If you look at all of the success, I mean, you cannot just throw away 30 years or 40 years or 50 years of software development and successful products and say, hey, we want to do something completely different in crypto. It's an added value to reward your users fairly for whatever they're contributing. But if they're coming to your app just because the token price went higher, that's, you know, you're going to lose them with the same pace that you earned them in the bear market, right? If your token price is not doing good. The good old Web2 way, how Waze did it, how Google Maps did it, is to provide a ton of utilities. So a smartphone, because of the way that it's structured, it has a display, it has all of these sensors, you can actually put a ton of utility. The way that we do it is dash cam, navigation, parking, and so on. Last but not least, people don't buy a smartphone to buy a Lamborghini, right? The ROI is already there. I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but, you know, people don't buy the smartphone for the expectation that they make money from Natix. They buy it because they're texting their friends. They buy it because they check their emails. They check Instagram and so on, right? So that's what makes it commodity. And also, you know, I think then we go to tokenomics and the emission system and so on, right? That's why we chose the smartphone over hardware. Otherwise, I mean, we were coming from the hardware world. But there are some claims that they say why smartphone doesn't work. So let me also go through them, because just saying what works with smartphone is not good enough. And I've seen, you know, Ariel is mentioning that why smartphone doesn't work. We wrote an extensive article of saying why actually smartphone works for mapping. One of the things that I have seen is position or location accuracy. You know, that GPS is not, providing a high quality localization accuracy. Well, even with the smartphone, you can tap into infrastructures like RTK and so on. We're actually, you know, chatting with the GeoNet team. We're going to do an announcement. They're also wanting to go towards kind of smartphone deployment. And you have other kind of, you know, means to increase localization accuracy. You have cellular, you have Wi-Fi connection. You do what is called data fusion or sensor fusion in order to increase the localization accuracy. And you can actually reach sub-meter level, even sub-decimeter level with a combination of these approaches. So localization accuracy is definitely, you know, reachable. I can even share some Google's work. Google did a competition on how they can increase the localization accuracy, and there are super strong proposals and solutions. I mean, these things, you can see the results of it, right? That they can reach sub-meter accuracy. This is not just a scientific paper that somebody did it in a controlled environment. These are, you know, tested stuff. It's also in our article. Then another thing that I heard is overheating. Yes, we had an overheating issue when we launched the application, but since then we have optimized the app on many different angles. On the edge computing side, or where the AI is running, that was consuming a lot of things. For example, we turn off your display after a while because display was very power consuming, right? So we did a lot of optimization, and right now, except some older Android phone, we don't have pretty much any issues. Then, you know, if we were a street level imagery kind of project, there was an argument that, you cannot collect consistent image sizes. Well, there's a simple answer to that. Yes, you can. Because, you know, most of the cameras since 4, 5, 6 years ago, they have a common denominator in terms of size of the camera. And the way that an app on the smartphone accesses the camera or takes a picture is very different from you going through the camera roll, where it cuts the picture for you, it beautifies it, and so on. There's a lot of filters and kind of software-based additions that get added, right? As an app, we get the raw data from the camera. So if we take actually the smallest, let's say, frame size that any camera, let's say since 20, or most of the cameras between 2011, 2012, can produce images on, you can just take that common denominator and always cut the picture like that when you're collecting data, right? And then on top of that, we have generative AI. I don't know if you guys have seen, I mean, this is maybe for 2-3 years down the road because it's still very expensive, but I don't know if you guys have seen, the Gen AI models that you can zoom back from a picture. You haven't. So essentially imagine you have a picture of me right now in this cut and you don't know what is the surrounding looking like, right? So the Gen AI is going to actually generate the surrounding based on a little information that it has, right? So there is, I don't know, a half of a lamp maybe above my head, and it's going to generate the entire lamp and so on. Same thing can go with the street level imagery. So again, smartphones can work perfectly fine, and you can address, technically you can address, you know, this kind of inconsistency between camera sizes in there. And all that aside, I mean, maybe we are just saying it because we are a smartphone deep in project, but I mean, there is a very successful Web2 project out there called Mapillary. They got acquired by Meta. They have been in 2020, actually. And they have been doing street level imagery using smartphone for many, many years. And when we are chatting with street level imagery project, the way that they tell us essentially is that, you know, they have their own high fidelity infrastructure. They have these super expensive cars that they use for street level imagery. You're not going to replace that with a phone nor with a dash cam. You're not going to do that because it has LiDARs. It does depth, you know, scanning and very precise localization using LiDAR, which is sub-centimeter literally accuracy. You're not going to replace that. They still have to do it every, you know, 1 or 2 years. But what smartphone street level imagery or any kind of hardware, let's say if you're using that, is going to enable them to collect data in between, let's say every year or 2 years that they're doing this high fidelity, image collection. So we are kind of an intermediary solution between every time they're doing very high fidelity mapping as a cheap way of, you know, acquiring data and fill their blind spots and increase the update frequency and be able to provide better services. So yeah, that's, I think this was the most extensive kind of place that I talked about why smartphone. And I think this should kind of clarify all of the statements that are out there that no, smartphones will not work. I mean, there's a bunch of arguments out there, but I think this should address pretty much all of them.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, time is also on your side because these devices only get more powerful and these networks only get more efficient over time. So I get it. That makes a lot of sense. Would love to maybe use that to segue to talk about, you know, the customers themselves and the demand side. People with phones, people who are driving on the road frequently. You know, I'd love sort of your high level map for how you think about who the target user is for Natix today and how that might evolve. Maybe think about it in terms of who the early adopters are and how you're going to cross the chasm to get to more mainstream.
You mean on the supply side or on the demand side of the network?
Let's talk about the supply side first, actually, if you don't mind, of the people that are actually deploying their phones and mapping for you. And then we'll talk about the demand side.
Sure. So we have two types of, I would say, supply side user personas. One of them is commuters. And these guys usually are driving between 8 to 10 a.m. and 4 to 6 p.m. local time. They go to work typically, most of the activity. So we always see the spike in our numbers and in the metrics that we have. I would say around half of our community is commuters. The other half is occupational drivers. Truck drivers, taxi drivers, Uber drivers. These guys are, you know, on the road for, you know, 8 hours a day, 6 hours a day, and they do most of the data collection. Now, we need both for the way that we have designed our network. Why do we need both? The guys who are heavy mappers, they are obviously valuable because they're doing the heavy lifting. They keep the data coming, right? We always have data coming. We can mobilize our network through navigation, through missions that we have in the app. So these guys are perfect for us to be able to collect data the fastest whenever we require it. Now, commuters give a different perspective into this whole story. As I said, we are also providing utility in this app, right? Navigation, parking, and so on. And most of these utilities are very interesting for the commuters, actually, rather than occupational drivers. We're also trying to add the, you know, utilities for occupational drivers, but, you know, for each one of them, it would be different. For truck drivers, it would be a different app than for taxi drivers, let's say. But, you know, the commuters are actually, you know, using the app. And why do I find this very powerful? I have also talked about it. You know, these driver assistant applications like parking and navigation, aside from the fact that they provide utility to these drivers, they also make the drivers, the in a way, the demand side of the network too. So because they're not just generating data, they are also using the data in form of navigation and parking. Now, for some of it, they wouldn't pay because navigation is free outside. But for some of it, they will end up paying, right? So they would even generate protocol revenue eventually. And then there is another added value. Things like navigation and parking that use network's data to get better over time, they're what we call network effect application. You guys might be familiar with this term. Facebook is a network effect application. The more users you have in your network, the better it gets, the quality of it for everyone. And that attracts more users to come into your network and use it, right? Same thing with parking and navigation. The more drivers we have, the more data they generate, the better the navigation will get. And that attracts more drivers to come to just use the service or the parking, for example, which is unique and is not even offered by Waze and some similar, you know, apps out there. So this introduces a very strong flywheel for the network to naturally grow. And we are going to have a ton of drivers and a ton of data, which is very hard for any data consumer to ignore us because we will have the strongest, you know, network in terms of collecting data and the strongest data sets for a lot of, you know, use cases and applications. And we will dominate the market. So this is another angle of looking at it, you know, when we are building the product. That's why commuters are very important part of our, you know, ecosystem, not just the guys who are doing heavy lifting in terms of driving 8 hours a day.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think, you know, it is so obvious, I think, for people that are on the road all the time. It is so obvious for people that are driving 3 to 4 hours a day. Part of me honestly just thinks a big part of what you have to do is a big marketing push, or what you have to do is maybe a big just social push over time. So, you know, I'd love to think about then, having thought about the supply side of this, like, how do you think about the demand side and then bringing everything together? Because you're going to have to be growing both of them sort of simultaneously, which is no easy task. You know, would love any color you can kind of provide on how you think about that.
Yeah. A shout out to all of the Deepin founders. What they're doing, because they are having this two-sided economy, is essentially two startups at the same time. Because, you know, we have seen startups doing just one side of the story, and that is by itself a hard thing to do. And when you want to do two sides of a, you know, market, it's really, really difficult, right? So what are the customer personas in terms of data? I would say the biggest customer persona for the model that we have right now are map and navigation service providers, what I also call geospatial data aggregators. Companies like Hero Technologies, Mapbox, Google Maps, you know, a bunch of them that are out there that you might not have even heard of them, but they're doing a lot of B2B service providing. Why do I call them geospatial data aggregators? Because what many people don't know is that these guys do not rely on a single source of data. To be able to provide consistent data to their end users, they have, you know, over thousands of sources of data in every continent, right? So one of these companies that we are in touch with, just in Europe, they have over 1,300 sources of data. And we are validating, you know, we are identifying different use cases, actually, as we speak. Some of the hot use cases that we have been, you know, working on for the past couple of months is, for example, dynamic speed limit signs. Cars in Europe need this information to be able to go level 3 autonomy. By law, they require this information. And these companies have huge blind spots in terms of this data. Dynamic speed limit signs is when the speed limit changes because of weather condition, construction, road construction, and so on, right? So, you know, this is a bottleneck for autonomous driving to be rolled out at the end of the day. That's a big thing. So that's why we need more frequent data, real-time data, and so on. The other kind of use case, which is more, I would say, less dynamic data, is road quality index. Essentially, it shows what is the quality of the road. They sell it to car manufacturers because they're designing cars for different, you know, parts of the world and different type of roads. They sell it to road operators, city planners, municipalities to kind of maintain the roads. And they also have serious, you know, gaps and blind spots and lack of update frequency. And, you know, Natix can help them with detecting potholes, cracks on the road surface, faded road markings, and so on. So this is, I would say, the easiest kind of and the top customer persona that we are working with. We're also working with, let's say, mobility solution providers, parking apps that, you know, have algorithms that they can heuristically tell you the probability of you finding a parking spot. The algorithm has a precision between 60% to 95%, 95% being when they have additional sources of real-time data, right? So these are other kinds of, you know, players that we are in conversations with. And yeah, we're actually scoping a couple of, you know, pilot projects for the usage of our data. And soon we're going to, you know, announce some good news regarding these. And I think this would validate the demand side as well. We're very confident ourselves about the demand side because of all of these conversations. We know that there is a demand for it, both because of our background in the geospatial data space, as well as the conversations that we are having. But soon we will put a, you know, a public announcement about a couple of these rolling out.
Hey, Matt, let me jump in with a quick question. Ollie, I want to go back to the demand side and ask you something that I've been, we've talked a little bit about, but it's on a very long time horizon. You obviously started on the fixed camera side, right? Like attaching devices to sort of like fixed cameras on buildings. One of the things I found really, to your point on passive versus active depends, I think one of the things that I found really compelling about Natix on a long-term basis is this idea that you're not actually just limited to roadside mapping, right? Someday you might tell someone like, hey, get out of the car, go walk around the mall, tell me like, you know, is my favorite shirt in this store? Or you might actually go back and integrate with a lot of the smart cameras that are out on buildings today. Like, do you, after the past year and a half of growing this on the mobility side, do you have more conviction that driving is like the thing to focus on forever? Or do you eventually see Natix going and expanding back into these other use cases? Like, just curious how you think about the long tail of what's possible with this community you've built.
I think driving is the low-hanging fruit and a good go-to-market, but there's just so much more. And, you know, when the time is right, it's much easier to also build those products. There are some stuff that I just cannot say it in a public podcast. I will say it to you guys, you know, about what we're building. But, you know, there is so much more in mapping, not the roads, but mapping indoor places and in general mapping, right? There's something called NERF, if you guys have heard of it, where you have this immersive view of an environment and you can kind of walk through it metaverse-like, right? There was a recent kind of work that was published by Google, and you can literally not go one-directional browsing, which is Google Street View, but you can do like walking around, and then you can build replicas of indoor environments. So we're talking shopping malls, we're talking, you know, monuments, pretty much everywhere. And yeah, this is just one use case that you can do, right? You can do the case that you were talking about. There are also companies in the two world that essentially send you scavenger hunting on the shelves of shops, you know, to collect certain data. And again, you know, once you have the camera infrastructure to run a certain computer vision AI for those applications is not that difficult, so that you're validating the data automatically rather than manual image collection, right? But all of these things are possible. And I think another thing that is also very attractive when we go towards CCTV cameras and drone cameras, you know, a lot of different applications come in. I give you one example, like drones are not only used for mapping. I know there are some projects that are using it for 3D mapping of the environment, but I give you another scenario that crowdsourced drones can be used. When there is a fire happening somewhere in California and there are people in the fire, right? You can just put a bounty that you send the drone in. And the drone has, you know, person detection, object detection and person detection. It detects a person, it grabs a screenshot and it communicates it back. And let's say for every person that the community is capturing, either you pay them money or some social credit because they're really helping something big, right? This is not mapping. This is you know, data collection, very targeted. And I think one of the beauties of Camera is that it's a very powerful sensor, but Deepin beauty is that you can mobilize your network whenever you need it very, very quickly, right? So imagine you have, you know, 10,000, 20,000 people with drones in California. And as soon as something like this happened, you just can orchestrate them super fast to go and you know, collect this kind of data. So yeah, there are quite a few other applications, both expanding the mapping side of the story, but outside the roads and driver category, but also going beyond mapping.
Yeah, one of the things that I think really clicked for Nadex in my mind was, you might have met our other portfolio company, Wi-Fi Map. These guys have like, you know, 5-6 million users going out and mapping public Wi-Fi networks globally. And the, you know, it really works because you can verify that, right? Like as a remote third party, like I can know that I can send a server request and know that somebody's actually on this Wi-Fi hotspot. They had, they're expanding right now to sort of like mapping some arbitrary things that are useful for these like travelers and tourists that they have. And so they've launched sort of public restroom, like let's map public restrooms that are both like clean and high quality and available in, you know, in major cities around the globe. And you can imagine this being like a multi, you know, billion-dollar asset or for someone if you get it into the right hands. You know, it turned out that verification of things was actually like a lot harder to verify whether a bathroom is available or clean or whatever than whether a Wi-Fi hotspot is sort of like giving good connectivity. I think these are the things that Nadex is super well equipped to partner with other crypto projects and like help them on the real world verification piece, which is the real bottleneck for launching a lot of Deepins. So I'm super pumped for you guys to as these devices get better, as the community keeps growing, as the demand side keeps getting more sophisticated, there's a ton of activity that I think we'll see. That's really exciting. So yeah, not a question, but just excited to hear more from you on like what's something that you think will be many years out for Nadex, but that, you know, you're most excited to see a use case or a product or some, you know, some milestone that is just like very, it feels important to you.
I think these safety applications are very, very interesting to me. And to be honest with you, I wasn't into this when I started Natix. I was more into creating a solid network, business case, revenue, you know, all the kind of the business metrics of the story. And then I just saw the sentiment of the community that, you know, which is, we want to build something that contributes towards the good of the world, right? Something that does good, essentially, right? How do we actually do that? We do product market fit surveys quite regularly using Sean Ellis's model to measure, you know, why people use the app. If we do have product market fit, what are the features that people don't care about? What are the features that they really like? And, you know, a lot of the users they mention as the reason why they're using the app is because they feel they're making the road safer for other people. So the example that I mentioned to you with this drone and something that happens, you know, that the city is on chaos and then you have fire and everything and you're saving lives. I think this goes beyond, you know, just mapping and having a better traffic system so that people can get from point A to B, you know, just faster and more efficient, or people can find parking spot. Those are good cases. People will pay money for them. But, you know, I think we can do better things with this camera network that is actually saving lives or increasing the quality of life, especially in places that the quality is relatively low. And yeah, that's I would say those kind of things I would like to see more with Natix.
Absolutely. That reminds me, I have a good friend that's starting to think about ideas around Deepin for police departments and is working on like incubating some stuff there. So I gotta get you guys in touch.
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we have, you know, camera network is extremely powerful. You need to somehow draw the line between being big brother versus, you know, just doing something good. And where do you define that good, right? Do we use this camera infrastructure to just, you know, together with the police to detect the license plates and you know, give them that information? okay, in short, that could be a good idea, right? There might be a criminal that is running away and, you know, we're helping to catch that criminal. But what if the guy who is requesting this has ill intentions, right? I mean, we see that in the movies and it can't actually happen. So, you know, this kind of privacy is a very, very interesting topic for me. Like, where do you draw the line? If you're privacy maxi, you should say no such a thing should be possible. You know, because when you're in between, it's very difficult to design all these rules around it so that people do not misuse it, right? It's almost impossible in my opinion. So yeah, having a camera infrastructure is extremely powerful and could be a big, you know, a big responsibility at the same time as well, because it can be misused. But yeah, there's a lot of these law enforcement cases that you can do with the same infrastructure. That's true.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, man, for coming and joining us. Is there, I think those are all the questions that Mahesh and I had on our side. Is there anything else you want to leave with the community on just where they can find you, things that they're upcoming to watch out for from the network, or exciting things that they can, yeah, they can keep an eye out for?
Yeah, so we have our token sales that is coming up soon. So we're going to, you know, have the public sale as well as the token listing. We have a very, very interesting airdrop program. So if you are a driver, you can join the airdrop program by downloading the app and driving around. You can find more information on this, by the way, in our website in the blog section. It's called Network Labs. If you're not a driver, you can join our, let's say, community platforms like Zili and soon to be Galaxy, I believe. So, and you can also be part of the airdrop program. The airdrop event will happen once we have hit 100 million kilometer, because we wanted to align all of the incentives, not just the TGE. Not just the token launch, but when we actually hit a big milestone within the network. And yeah, just generally, I would invite people to download the app and start using this, and feel free to give us your feedback, because we live off of it, essentially.
Awesome. Thank you, man. Yeah. Everyone go download Nadix and contribute to the community.